This is Barron's Live. Each weekday, we bring you live conversations from our newsrooms about what's moving the market right now. On this podcast, we take you inside those conversations, the stories, the ideas, and the stocks to watch so you can invest smarter. Now, let's dial in.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Barron's Live, our daily webcast and podcast. I'm Lauren Rublin, Senior Managing Editor of Barron's. Thanks for joining us today to discuss the week ahead in stocks and investments in space. My guests today are Barron's senior writer Al Root and Peter Beck, the founder, CEO, and Chief Technology Officer of Rocket Lab, one of only two U.S. companies delivering regular access to orbit. The other, of course, is Elon Musk's SpaceX. Rocket Lab, as Al wrote recently, has completed 18 launches to space, sending 97 satellites into orbit on behalf of more than 20 customers. It has launch pads in Virginia and New Zealand, each of which can handle 44 launches a year. The company is slated to come public sometime in the second quarter through a merger with Vector Acquisition Corporation, a special purpose acquisition company, or SPAC. Rocket Lab is one of several young companies leading the next race to space, which Al wrote about in a Barron's cover story in the March 22nd issue. It's an exciting time for the industry and investors, and for anyone interested in space exploration. Welcome, Peter and Al, and I'm so glad you could join me on Barron's Live today. Peter is dialing in from New Zealand, so forgive us if we have any technical troubles.
Hi, how's everyone? Well, thank you, Lauren.
A pleasure. So before we launch into a discussion of space, I just want to spend a few minutes speaking with Al about what's happening in the market, which is down today on somewhat unusual news. There's been a margin call triggered Friday on a U.S. hedge fund, which led to sharp drops in fund holdings such as Viacom CBS, Discovery Communications, and China's Baidu, among other stocks. And the news seems to have led to losses in the shares of several big banks doing business with the fund and has clobbered those banks' shares. So, Al, can you fill us in on what is happening this morning?
Sure. It is an interesting time, Lauren. In one respect, you could almost say Wall Street is at it again. It's a story about hedge funds, complicated financial derivatives, leverage, and large international banks. So what's happened is there's a hedge fund, allegedly a hedge fund. They haven't confirmed it with us or any other news organization, to my knowledge, called Archegos, excuse my pronunciation. They managed about $10 billion in assets, but they leveraged that up by borrowing more money and bought more than $30 billion worth of securities. And when you borrow that much money, you pledge those securities as collateral, and some of these stocks started falling, so you have to either pledge collateral or a broker will take that asset and sell it to cover his loans. When things get really bad, if leverage gets really high, the seized collateral and the sale doesn't cover the loans. So you've had a couple of banks, you've had Credit Suisse and Nomura, both say that they have lost. Nomura put a number on it, lost about $2 billion dealing with this client that we believe is Archegos. Goldman Sachs told us this morning that, the loss from their position won't be material because they were ahead of the situation. It's a lot like long-term capital management of 1998, except a very light version. So that episode, yeah, go ahead.
No, I was going to say that would be very scary to liken it to long-term capital. So I'm glad it's just a small version.
Yes, it's long-term capital light, right? Not to be too funny about it. Long-term capital had $1 trillion in exposure and almost managed to bring down the entire financial system. Federal Reserve had to get everybody in a room and broker a deal to build a fund. We're dealing with the tens of billions. So you're going to get select stocks hammered, and you're going to get, Viacom stock was down 50% last week, instead of another 5%. So it'll be some strange price moves. You'll get a little bit of nervousness from investors, which I think you're seeing today. But this will just be one to watch and learn something from, as opposed to really being worried about the broader themes of the market.
But we'll see if it has echoes. Let's switch to your space story. You've been covering the space industry for a while, whether it's old space, that is well-established aerospace companies, or new space companies like Rocket Lab. So I wonder, for readers who might have missed it, if you can give us a quick summary of your cover story of a couple of weeks ago.
Sure. So this is a story of falling costs, right? Enabling new businesses. The cost to reach low Earth orbit has fallen by orders of magnitude. Satellites, you know, used to cost up to $500 million. Now you can get a very capable satellite for a few million dollars. And that combination of things enables lots of innovation, new business models. And companies like Rocket Lab are trying to take advantage. Now, in the past, you really only had the large aerospace and defense franchises as your space exposure. Now there's six or seven pure play space companies, including Rocket Lab, that are coming to market that all offer investors sort of different segments of the space industry. Rocket Lab can build satellites, they launch rockets as well. You have companies that are putting up hundreds of satellites around the Earth, building what they call constellations to offer new data services. People play on high-speed internet access, they play on mobile phone service, they're imaging the Earth. So it is sort of an exciting time, I'd say.
So Peter, tell us how you came to found Rocket Lab and what the company aims to do at this point.
Yeah, it's Lauren. Well, it's a really fascinating time in space. What you're basically witnessing is the democratization of space. So, you know, there have been dramatic changes in both the architecture and the environment. That's enabled Rocket Lab to come in and do the job that typically done in the past. But for us, you know, as pointed out, we are one. Two that are regular, but we just frequently launched rocket in America. In fact, the fourth most frequently launched rocket in the entire world. But I think what's more interesting about what we're doing here is it's not just a pure play on launch or a pure play on satellites. To be very good from an end-to-end solution. So, you know, we build rockets, the rocket, we build the satellite, we operate the satellite, and it's a complete end-to-end service.
So what distinguishes your company from other space startups?
Well, I think the biggest thing is that we're actually in orbit. There is a tremendous amount of kind of promise to them and hype. But the kind of the first distinction is actually, you know, having a month or thereabouts, you know, seen a space with customers a lot. And personally, very.
We're having a little trouble hearing you today.
Sorry about that. We are complete end to end. So we do launch, we do satellites, we even do the applications, the end applications that customers use.
So tell me, what sort of growth do you see ahead in space exploration?
Well, there's a massive, massive upside opportunity here because we're in the same era right now where as the options were being opened and the aviation industry was being opened, that's kind of where we're at with space. So there's huge opportunity for growth within this sector.
And what are some of the pitfalls?
Well, I think there's a tremendous amount of problems. I think it needs to be careful to do diligence and see who is who's actually buying in, and also understand the risks, because this is a very digital industry in the fact that either you get there or you don't, just halfway to orbit or halfway in the space industry. So I think the pitfalls are to ensure that investors really do their diligence on the companies that they're looking to invest in, and actually have real products
Al, I would ask you, since you've covered a range of companies, what do you think investors need to know when they look at some of these young startups?
Well, a couple of things. I think that, like Peter said, everybody needs to do their due diligence, right? You know, he likened it to the opening of the aerospace industry. I think that's a good analogy. But right now, the industry is very young. So it's, I would liken it almost to like the internet boom. And we're not there by any means with stock prices, but my point is you had a lot of internet companies, and then you ended up with Amazon.com and others. So there will be winners and losers. So you're going to have to, you know, take a couple of approaches. You can hold a basket of stocks and believe that, you know, hitting the big winners will make up for any losses, or you're going to have to do a lot of due diligence on management teams. You know, we picked Rocket Labs as our sort of high-growth speculative bet. And one of the reasons is because space is really hard, and they're already doing it with a commercial business carrying for carrying customers. So that was one of the reasons we felt like, okay, this is a more reasonable bet because, like I say, they're already reaching space and conducting launches. I believe they've conducted a few already in 2021.
So what sort of growth do you see going forward, and what do you see, Peter, I'll ask you, what is the purpose of the new space race? Is it to colonize new worlds or to spread our problems beyond our galaxy, or is it simply to satisfy our curiosity and extend our scientific knowledge?
Yes, I mean, there's a number of pieces out there, but the most important to kind of remember here is how much we rely on space in our everyday lives. I think you know, it's all hidden infrastructure, so I'm not sure that people realize how much space is relied upon. Whether it be ordering Uber Eats, which is all kind of enabled by GPS, or beam from space, even a satellite television. You know, I think, you know, our thesis at Rocket Lab is we go to space to improve life on Earth. And there are a number of other things that go to space. You know, humans are multiplanetary species, which is equally as valid, but maybe not build the infrastructure but that that we use every day here on Earth.
Al, you wrote about satellites in your piece and how satellites used to be gigantic and now they've become actually rather small. What, explain the evolution to us and what's the best way to invest in this sort of change?
The two most interesting things that I like to say about satellites is, one, it is just a miniaturization of technology, right? Chips get cheaper, electronics get cheaper. And finally, that has reached its way to space. And the second thing is that's really shifted the risk paradigm of the industry because, you know, I think somebody explained to me that the last Mars rover, not the one that's sending nice panoramic visions back down to Earth now, the one before that, which was launched a few years ago, it effectively had like a tiny computer and a 2-megapixel camera. And you can't even get those things anymore. And the reason that NASA picked them is because they could build redundancies. They knew exactly what they were getting. They're so risk averse because of the high cost of failure that the innovation rate sort of stagnated in space. And now when you have 100 satellites that cost $5 million, if you lose a satellite or have a problem with a satellite, that's not a catastrophic risk of failure. So you can afford to take a lot more risk with that kind of paradigm. And not to mention, if you have to fix something or have to replace something, a company like Rocket Labs can get you back into space at $2,000 or $3,000 a kilogram. Back when the space shuttle was flying, that was like $50,000 a kilogram to reach space. So just the size of miniaturization of these things and the falling cost has enabled, you know, so many new business models, satellites, imaging the Earth 100% of the time in radar, in optical cameras, in infrared, trying to sell all this data to global logistics firms, energy producers, deforestation, governments, defense and intelligence agencies. It is sort of really just a new era in commercial space.
So why have costs fallen so much?
So the great line about this, there's two things, right? The good old-fashioned capitalism competition, right? you know, so we were launching very few satellites and very few things in space, in the U.S. at least, back in the mid-aughts. The space shuttle had been decommissioned, and the things had become so bad for the industry that Boeing and Lockheed sort of put together their launch franchises and built ULA. And they were the only American launch provider. And shockingly, you had a monopoly, cost doubled. And it led to this sort of famous exchange between SpaceX president as well as Elon Musk in two separate periods, where you know the government said, you know, how can you, you know, launch rockets for you know a quarter of the cost of ULA? We don't really get it. And SpaceX responded, well, we don't really know how to answer that because we don't know how to build a $400 million rocket. So it's part reusability, part miniaturization of technology. Smaller rockets are reaching space now. I mean, ULA can carry 20 tons into space. A Rocket Lab rocket, I believe, carries 300 kilograms. So again, part of the reason, Lauren, is that idea of the risk paradigm. If a launch costs a few million bucks for a small rocket, you can afford to take more risks, be more aggressive with manufacturing and technology. And that sort of really jump-started people falling down the cost curve again.
Got it. So another thing I'd like to ask, we've talked about the divide between old space companies and new space companies. So among the old space companies, we're talking about companies like Lockheed Martin and Boeing. What sort of role do you see them playing, Al, in the new space race?
So that's a great question. And I would say that the merger between old space and new space is already here, and that we should just sort of think about it in terms of commercial space and different customer segments and different rocket capabilities, right? So if you line up all of the rockets that are currently reaching orbit, it's a lot like Peter was saying in terms of developing with the aerospace industry. You almost see increasing size, right? So you have rockets that can carry 100 kilograms, 300 kilograms. SpaceX Falcon 9, I think, is around 9 tons in its base configuration. And then the ULA rockets made by Boeing and Lockheed, they're the big ones. They can carry 20, 25 tons. And you see that all of these different markets can develop for different customers. And there's a proliferation. So, you know, maybe I'm taking this analogy too far, but, you know, we get on 737s when we need short trips. We get on 777s when we're flying across the sea. And that's the sort of opportunity that different companies will have to carve out niches for themselves. So I wouldn't say that it's, oh, Lockheed is old space. They just sell services to the government and it's no growth. I would say they have a particular technology right now that is at the high end of the space industry. They're going to have to make decisions on who they want to serve down the road. But everybody will ultimately be competing for the same customers, just like SpaceX, you know, stole some business from the Air Force from ULA back in 2014-2016 timeframe.
And if I recall correctly, you actually liked Lockheed Martin's stock.
I do. There's two reasons, right? It's the premier maker of combat aircraft in the world. Listen, it's a defense company. It's going to trade like a defense company. It trades at a very reasonable price-to-earnings ratio. Has a very reasonable dividend. So it's a good idea. It's a good, you know, it's a good company, solid valuation, a good old-fashioned value. From space, I think they have one of the most complete space franchises. They can build satellites, they can launch satellites, and they can build rocket parts. They just are in the process of purchasing Aerojet Rocketdyne for about $4 billion. And so they have a nice broad space business, which can grow multiple ways, either as the satellites, number of satellites launched grows, or as the launches grow.
So, Peter, do you expect to see some of the smaller space companies acquired by some of the larger, more traditional space players?
Yeah, look, traditionally, last year, Raytheon acquired Blue Canyon, which was a smaller company. So definitely, as older space tries to play in some of the markets, dramatically different price points than absolutely. But I think also there's the possibility that you might see the inverse of that as well, as new space companies grow and start to.
That would be interesting for sure.
Mm.
And SPACs have been a very popular vehicle for bringing new space companies to the public market. Why do you think space and SPACs have been such a popular combination?
Yeah, so I mean, for us, we were already on the phone.
Sorry about the sound. We're having a little trouble hearing you.
Already on part of traditional IPO. So a SPAC was great for us because it just accelerated that. I think SPAC appeal with this company, large amounts of capital that are required to do this well. But one of the things I do worry about is some space companies using a SPAC is kind of like last to achieve that funding round. And everybody here knows that going public is a huge commitment. Like I said, for us, we were on a trajectory for a traditional IPO, and this accelerated us, which is particularly useful.
Got it. So let's switch for a moment to life on Earth and get away from space. But first, I want to tell listeners we'll take questions at the end of the call if you have any. So, Al, here on Earth, you cover Tesla and electric vehicle companies, and Tesla is expected, that's true, you've done a ton of writing about both. Tesla is expected to report first quarter deliveries this week, and the forecasts have actually been falling, in part due to a global chip shortage. What is the outlook for Tesla's deliveries?
So, excellent point. You laid it out perfectly. There is a shortage of microchips. It's partly a legacy of the pandemic. It's a legacy of technology changeovers that I don't entirely understand, but semiconductor companies all say they are working on it. It's a billion-dollar profit headwind for the industry. Tesla deliveries in Q1. So they delivered 500,000 cars in 2020. They're supposed to deliver, they hope, Wall Street hopes, I should say, they'll deliver 800,000 cars in 21. They were supposed to deliver maybe 180,000 vehicles in the first quarter, and let's say that's down to about 165, and that is 100% a function of the global chip shortage. Analysts are not cutting them for lack of demand or anything like that. They just don't know what to make of it. It's a little bit compounded by the fact that Tesla almost never says anything, so we're always sort of seeing what like General Motors said is like flying into Tesla and things like that.
So, presumably, once the chip shortage is cleared up, this should no longer be a problem for the company.
Yeah, I think so. Now, it's interesting because if you look at General Motors before, so they are both saying, like, hey, listen, it's going to be a billion-dollar profit headwind. It should wrap itself up by the second half of the year. Those stocks are still up, like, 35% year-to-date. Economic recovery, some exciting management plans for EVs. So investors are like, okay, fine, no problem. EV stocks, on the other hand, are much more highly valued, and it seems like almost any bad news has shaken those stocks. Tesla stock is down almost 33% from its January 52-week high, and it's down a little more than 10% year-to-date now. So the market has treated the same data points. I would argue the market has treated the same data points in very different ways, which is interesting.
That's interesting. So what has happened to EV stocks, though, more broadly? They were market darlings last year, and this year they've had a pretty steep sell-off. What's going on?
They've been terrible. There's three things going on. This chip shortage, that's definitely part of it. We've had rising interest rates. Rising interest rates hurts high-growth stocks in two ways, right? It makes it harder to finance growth, and present value of all those wonderful future cash flows that Tesla will deliver us someday or worth a little less when interest rates are higher. So higher interest rates has been a factor. The chip shortage has been a factor. And, there's been this, this is a bit of the same theme, but we have had a rotation from, some of these high-flying stocks as the economy starts to recover into the other part of my life, which is in some of these cyclical industrials, Caterpillar, John Deere, and things like that. Those stocks are doing excellent for a while there, and you know this better than anybody. You know, the Dow Jones Industrial Average, it was like it was the new NASDAQ for about 6 weeks when interest rates started to rise. So that's taking some of the steam out of the electric vehicle space as well.
That makes perfectly good sense. So before we go to listener questions, I do want to take a quick look at this week's economic reports. Thursday, the Institute for Supply Management will release its manufacturing index for March. And Al, you told me that's your favorite data point of the week. I have to say, not many people have a favorite economic data point. What is so special to you about the PMI manufacturing index, and what sort of reading are you expecting?
So I like it because I love everything with smokestacks and wheels, or rocket engines for that matter. you know, it's the condition of the manufacturing sector, right? The lifeblood of the economy. It's better to look at, you know, some of the leading indicators that come out coincidentally with it. So they'll give order rates, and they'll give prices, and they'll give customer inventories. And all of these numbers have these, you know, they all base it around 50. So if it's above 50, it's growing. If it's below 50, it's shrinking. You should be seeing numbers in the high 50s or 60 for all of those sorts of things. So if orders are coming in 60, if customer inventories are low, that means customers will have to order eventually. If production is ramping up past 50, you know, that'll be more good news for the industrial space.
And we've seen some pretty good news so far as the economy begins to open up.
So, yeah, I mean, in all honesty, you look at some of these industrial stocks, many of which we've written about, and it's kind of like every day, it's like a new 52-week high. I don't want to get carried away, but you know, industrials are like the EVs in Q1 of, you know, last year.
Well, it's been a long time coming for the industrials. So let's go to some questions. This is a question I'll pose to Peter. It comes from Mark. How do we manage the trash created by out-of-date satellites?
Yeah, that's a very – and I think this thing rock landed later on. In fact, you know, we even went to the UN on this one. And management of space asset is what a lot of people don't understand is 50% of all of the junk in orbit is not dead satellites, dead rockets. So going to orbit in a way that we do to bits of dead rockets is kind of there needs to be better regulation. There needs to be much better controls around orbital position, but also orbital debris in the future. So we're a strong proponent of you know, trying to make sure that there's better controls and that we use space in a more sustainable way.
That makes sense, and Laura, it's kind of a global issue. Rajiv asks, yes, Al, go ahead.
I was going to say, there's already startups with plans to basically be the trash collectors of space. Whether it's Astroscale, people can Google Astroscale, or D-Orbit, there's companies that already are proposing to clean some of this stuff up.
So good. We certainly don't want all that debris flying around. So Al, Rajiv asks, do you think that EV stocks and Tesla will start to recover in the second quarter?
Well, it's a standard joke. Everybody makes it. If I knew that, I would resign and then I would be rich.
right.
Listen, the EV sector continues to have a lot of tailwinds, which are good things. There's very likely going to be EV tax credits from Joe Biden in his economic stimulus plan, President Joe Biden, excuse me. There is a lot of incentives and continued strong demand for electric vehicles in China. This is a bit of a hiccup. You know, if interest rates settle down and demand continues to be solid, there's no reason they shouldn't recover. But we all have to argue with the market gods about what you should pay for an EV stock. So I would say that more good news is coming. And, you know, for the first 3 months, we've had more bad news, which was a bit of a shock to everyone. So on balance, you know, I don't see anything terrible happening to EV stocks this year. The reason that you would get really pessimistic is if you saw some sort of demand decline, but that just isn't the case right now.
All right. Well, thank you for clarifying. I'm afraid that's all the time we have for today, but Peter, I want to thank you for calling in from New Zealand. We really appreciate it. And Al, thanks for your insights into the market and space and the EV industry. And thanks to our listeners for tuning in. Tomorrow, MarketWatch reporter Meera Jagannathan and personal finance columnist Quentin Fotrell will discuss the MarketWatch series Dispatches from a Pandemic, which blends personal finance advice with tales of life amid the pandemic. This is one of MarketWatch's most popular series and has helped countless readers cope with the perils of the past year, from lockdowns to layoffs to insurance problems to disrupted retirement plans. So please tune in for tomorrow's call. Thanks again, everyone. Stay well and have a good day.